So welcome to day three of our retreat. It always amazes me how in just a short time one can go quite deeply, one can go on quite a journey on a retreat. And it seems to be that depending on how much time, that's whatever you need to do happens within the time of the retreat. So if you're on a 2-week retreat, maybe it takes you a lot longer to settle and you go on a sort of like a journey over a longer period of time. But if you've just got a weekend, somehow it all happens in a weekend. A bit like doing housework, whatever time you've got available, that's what time it takes. I think it's the same with a retreat. Whatever time you've got available, that's what you do, what you need to do, or your psyche does what it needs to do. So yes, on a retreat we are on this individual journey as well as on a collective journey. And I think it's quite helpful to keep both those in mind. Because again, that's another way of working with that fundamental delusion we have about ourselves being separate from others and not realising the connection, the interconnection. And it's there all the time, isn't it? I just always find myself noticing ways that I do that. There's a phrase that the Buddha, the Buddha uses sometimes in some of his in the early Pali teachings, and that kind of sticks in my mind and comes back from time to time, which is, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself. Yeah, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself. And yet I spend so much of my time, I spent so many years trying to sort of work out who is me and get a sense of identity and sense of feeling really, yes, this is me, and working out what I kind of think as being mine or not mine. And there's a paradox in that, because I think there's that whole thing about that sense of self and letting go of that sense of self. Pranyanita talked last night about releasing the ego and the self, but not abandoning the self. I think that's an important distinction. So we're trying to, in a way, loosen or see through our experience and view of ourselves as the center of the world and relating to everything in terms of how it affects us, and trying to protect this idea that we have of ourself, that the ego at least has of ourself, because often those views we have ourself are very narrow. They don't include a whole range of our experience and our qualities. It's much more coming from the ego and the thinking mind, and sometimes how we want to be seen or how other people have, you know, told us, and we kind of get this fixed view or idea of who we are, what we're like. That doesn't allow for change or growth or transformation. Or maybe that's a little bit sweeping, because sometimes our fixed view of ourselves is somebody that's into healing and transformation or on a spiritual path. So there's a certain amount of allowing ourselves to change, but not too much. Not anything that will actually threaten our ego identity or our carefully built up life with, this is what I'm doing, this is my career, this is my home, these are my friends, this is my family, this is what I want to do, this is what I don't want to do. In a way, I can't remember where it is, but I remember there's one time when Sangharaksha talks of us being all kind of like a bundle of habits, you know, mostly bad habits, he said. And I think often we can confuse our sense of who we are by just what we do, or what we have done, or what we think, or believe, and our views. Which is one reason why it can be so helpful to come back more into that experience of the body. The body is the body. The body is not going to have views about itself. We'll have an experience of the body if we allow ourselves to. Body has its own wisdom. The body has a memory of all our experiences. And sometimes when we meditate, we do find memories being released or energy being released, some of which is pleasant, some of which may be unpleasant and very challenging, maybe even traumatic sometimes. But also the body does have that memory of pleasant things and joy. But I think the body is much more, well, literally down to earth and not really into bullshitting in the way that we can, in our minds, we can kid ourselves in all kinds of different ways. The ego is very slippery and sneaky and clever in that way. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the ego. I think we can get into sort of like talking about ego clinging and wanting to let go of the ego, releasing the ego. But actually, the ego is part of us. You know, just as our bodies are part of us, our hearts are part of us, our unconscious, you know, in a way, it's just a way of thinking about particular aspects or conditions. And I do think it is very important not to feel that we have to get rid of the ego, break down the ego, even transcend the ego until we have actually a really secure sense of self and identity. That may sound a paradox, but I think it's true. I think often people try to get there too quickly when they haven't established the calm, the positivity, all the stuff that we're trying to do in shamatha practice. And then it can be very, very damaging, you know. Can lead to breakdown, psychosis, all kinds of things, or just really undermining, shattering our sense of identity and self in a way that we don't necessarily know how to put ourselves back together again afterwards. So I'm not trying to be doom and gloom, but I suppose, want to say that in working to sort of soften and loosen and see through some of the effects of that view of ourselves as separate, it's not that we're not a self. Well, I mean, we are not a self, but we experience as ourselves and we go through life as a self. And it's a bit crazy making if you're going through your life and pretending you don't exist, or that you're an illusion, or that body is an illusion, or that everybody else is an illusion and everything around you is an illusion. Because on one level, yeah, that may be true. And on another level, we do actually exist, other people exist, you know, the world exists, and that, you know, there is the conditioned world that we are inhabiting and we are a part of. Anyway, how did I get into that? So today I'm looking at the third precept, and the third precept is about undertaking not to misuse energy. And if we look at the traditional precepts, that would be I undertake to abstain from sexual misconduct. And in Tri Ratna, we also have the positive version of that, what we're trying to aspire to, with stillness, simplicity and contentment, I purify my body. So again, it may take a little while to try and make sense of the connections and how we get from I undertake to abstain from sexual misconduct to I undertake to not to misuse energy. And what does it mean to misuse energy? And what is energy in the first place? I do feel very tempted to go down a really long rabbit hole exploring the whole idea of energy and different kinds of energy. But I'm not going to do that. But I am just sort of like a little bit interested in, say, how different it is when people are describing it in sort of scientific terms, like physics, energy, or when people are talking about it in terms of emotional energy or creative energy, or, you know, or then maybe somebody who's doing sports or martial arts, they'll have a very different kind of view and take and description of energy. And then, of course, anyone who's on any kind of spiritual path will also probably be at some point talking about spiritual energy. I mean, physics talks very much in terms of just there's two types of energy. There's kinetic energy, which is what happens from movement, the energy generated from movement, and then there's potential energy, which in a way is stored energy, which is stored in an object. And they look at energy in terms of potential work that can be done as well. It's all very, I think it just keeps it, you know, it's very fascinating. But just the phrase potential energy, looking at it not as a physicist or scientist, that resonates with me. And I think we all have this potential energy. You know, I suppose, again, that idea of the seed is potential energy. And then there's the energy that's being stored, accumulated, or that potential energy, and then we can make use of that energy. And I think that's where this third precept comes in about, well, how do we use it? Do we misuse it, or do we use it in a skillful way? And I think for me, with the tantric precepts, I'm using exactly the same criteria that I would be using with the traditional precepts. You know, what dictates whether something is skillful or unskillful is basically the emotional mental state behind the action, the intention behind the action, the degree to which it's coming from and influenced by those three root poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. So in a way, the third precept in the traditional set of five precepts is looking at a very particular way that we might use energy in terms of our sexual energy, you know, or our sexual interactions. And I think the Buddha did once say that, you know, if there was another human drive as strong as, you know, sex, then probably no one would ever get enlightened. You know, it's very strong. It has a big influence on us, everybody, in different kinds of ways. And it's very easy to get into, I suppose, craving and just trying to get what we want at the expense of others. And when I think about that precept in that very specific form of undertaking to abstain from sexual misconduct, I mean, apparently in the early days it was very much around things like abduction and rape and, you know, forcing oneself on someone. And probably most of us, that's not something that we do a lot. And maybe for us, it's much more about being more aware, more subtle, more sensitive about when, in a way, we're using sex to get what we want, or we're manipulating, or, you know, something about that relationship. It's not about who your partner is, it's not whether you're married or not married, or all those external things, but it's much more relational. And is it coming from a place that you might be harming the other person? Or you might be harming yourself, or is it a place that can be nourishing and healing and, you know, bring all that kind of connection and joy that is potential, you know. Sex can be completely alienating, and sex can be completely joyful, and all kinds of places in between. But a lot of that depends on how we approach it, our view of it, our relationship with the other person. You know, and it, you know, it is uncomfortable, isn't it, if there's an imbalance that one person cares more about the other. you know, and the other person might be involved in something in the sexual relationship more out of convenience or habit or anything else, rather than they're in love and the other person is in love. I think that could be a way of looking at it. And there's also, like, when we... there can be so much of a power dynamic that comes out in sexual relationships, and if that's not mutual, I suppose that's again another problem. But anyway, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about sex, just trying to kind of create a bit of context. Yeah, and also I do think these positive precepts, which again might feel a little bit of a, you know, how do you connect sexual misconduct to cultivating stillness, simplicity and contentment? Well, I suppose when you have that stillness, simplicity and contentment, you are not likely to be acting in ways, you know, that might harm somebody. If we're content, you know, there's a sense of equanimity, tranquility, of stillness, and of not being driven so much by craving or ill will that underlies that, you know. So if we can cultivate those steps, and I do think it is all interesting again that in the positive precepts they've been linked with purifying the body. I think purifying is a word that may have all kinds of associations and resonances, and I know part of me is like, but another part of me realises that actually, to the extent that all our actions have consequences and some actions have beneficial ones and some actions have harmful ones, there is a kind of process. You know, we may have accumulated a whole lot of negative seeds or memories in the body, and the more that we can cultivate those sort of more positive experiences, more kind, caring, compassionate, joyful, content, tranquil experiences that come alongside those awakening factors, maybe as part of that process, there is a purifying experience actually. But anyway, misusing energy. Well, I think there's something about, there's a certain amount of energy available, and physics tells us very much that we can't create energy. So if we're sitting there and we're trying to develop all this loving energy, we can't just create it out of nothing, you know. Or we're kind of creating the conditions where we can connect with it either within or without. You know, we all have that capacity for love and compassion within, but there's also all that love and compassion out in the world that we can also connect with. We're not like individually creating metta or compassion or joy or equanimity. You know, those are qualities. Those are qualities out there in the world, dharmic qualities, and the qualities within us as well. And it's much more that we create the conditions where those seeds can grow within us, or we can connect with that in the world, and the two can kind of become much more closely linked. Which is another reason why it's quite interesting that sometimes if we try too hard to make something happen or to bring something in being, it can be counterproductive. Whereas if we actually open up, create that space, potential space, where that potential energy can be freed and liberated, that can actually work a lot better. So yes, for me, it's very much about any of my actions of body, speech and mind, they are expressions of energy. You know, energy can't be created. Apparently it can't be destroyed, but it can change form. And it can transform. maybe use slightly different words like transferring or converting it, you know, if you're a physicist. But I suppose in one way, you know, like if we eat something that creates more energy within us, that sort of that energy is being converted. If there's a sort of exchange between us and someone else, there can be energy, a flow of energy, but we're not creating new energy. There is this idea of the conservation of energy, and when you're conserving energy in a sort of like physics, from a physics perspective, there's this law of the conservation of energy, which is basically that in a closed and isolated system, and if that system is closed and isolated from its surroundings, the total energy of the system will be conserved. Yeah. So it's like completely closed in, and then the energy is conserved. So I think that's very different to my experience of energy, actually. But I think I do have that kind of view, even if it's not always conscious, that there is a limited amount of energy, like there's a limited amount of metal, or there's a limited amount of generosity. And if, you know, if I give, then I'm going to just get drained, and then I'll reach a point where there's nothing left to give. And, you know, maybe there's only so much metal or love available, you know, so if someone's giving love to someone else, maybe they won't be it for me. Or if I give it to someone, how much will I have left for this? You know, I know it's not true. Experientially, I know it's not true, but sometimes it kind of influences my behaviour and my actions, you know. Whereas I do have a lot of experience of how that connection, that interconnection, that exchange and flow of energy can be very... well, it gives me more energy, a different kind of energy. It can, you know, if I'm feeling really low, and actually I spend some time, say, with a good friend, or I spend some time meditating, or I do a mantra, then my energy can be changed, can be transformed, and I can be in a much more positive and have a lot more energy. In one of my past incarnations, I was a massage therapist and healer. And people sometimes used to think, well, don't you get drained by doing massage, you know? And, you know, there was a limit to how many I would do a day. And obviously there's a sort of physical, you know, physical energy that gets used. But you can, in a way, a lot of it is about finding ways where you can do the massage with expending the minimum amount of energy just by using, you know, I suppose, force and natural things without having to feel that you're doing it all, you know. And it's quite interesting that sometimes just being still has much more effect. Just resting your hands on somebody, you know, for 5 minutes or 10 minutes can have more effect than half an hour of digging away, you know. Sometimes even working above the body with people's subtle energy will have a lot more energy, more effect. But I suppose why I was bringing that up is because I often you try to get yourself in as positive a state as you could, and you would need to be very aware of yourself and your body and your energy and any moods and the things while you're giving the massage. And in a way, I very much saw massage as a way of connecting with that person, helping them to kind of develop a bit more mindfulness and metta towards themselves and their body. I didn't say that to them, but that was underlying there. You know, it's very much a thing about helping them become more aware of their body, because a lot of people, and I used to be like that, might be very cut off from their body or very alienated from their body and not really experience their body. So even just when you put your hand on a part of the body, that makes them aware that that part of the body exists. Yeah. But anyway, I suppose, yeah, I'm going off again, but the reason I was bringing up the massage is that even if I was feeling quite tired or thinking, oh, I don't know if I've got the energy for this massage, actually, I would say probably about 99% of the time when I gave a massage, I would end up feeling energized and in much more positive states. I think maybe two or three times I came across someone and it was just right from the start a really unpleasant experience. It was like there was no kind of sense of receptivity or exchange, that you were just almost like you were just treating them as a physical body, whereas normally there's a sort of energetic body on different kinds of levels and exchange there. And there would be that time often it would feel like there's a coldness. It was draining, a bit like doing a massage of a black hole. And then at the end of that, you wouldn't feel great. But that, I think, only happened two or three times ever. And that's interesting because that was because there didn't feel like there was a connection or an exchange, you know. And I think when we do have that, when there is that flow of energy, then it can change, but it doesn't necessarily drain us. So that example that Pradyunita talked about how, well, you can have these emotional vampires. Yes, I like that phrase a lot, yes. And I know in the past I have been an emotional vampire. When I first started coming on retreats, I would be the person you really didn't want in your group. Because I was just so needy emotionally, but I wasn't able to like ask for it or accept it or know what I wanted. I would just be like, gimme, 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 and it would never sort of fulfill me because I didn't even know what I wanted, you know, other than not to feel as bad as I did or this sense of needing what other people had. Or just actually being with someone, being in company of other people to say that I didn't feel so bad, you know. It's not a pleasant experience to be an emotional vampire. It's not a pleasant experience when you're in the company of someone who is sort of draining your time and energy and in that kind of a way. But you can have somebody who's in incredible distress and suffering, going through major, major things. You know, their life's falling apart, having bereavements, they're, you know, maybe they've got a terminal diagnosis or something, maybe they're dying. And yet you can be with all of that emotion in a way that actually you witness it, you share it, and there can be something really profound happening between you. And you can actually come out of there again feeling really, really grounded, really inspired and opening. You know, that sense of what closes us down and what opens us. Our minds and our hearts, the big mind, the small mind. And when we're trying to conserve our energy or whatever it is, keep it me and mine, that closes us down. And that, I think, gets in the way of that kind of exchange. Whereas when we can be much more receptive and open, then it is possible to have that sense of being part of the world, connected, interconnected, and different levels of awareness and being, including our potential and our spiritual potential may get more into our consciousness. And I know, even, you know, when I hadn't done much spiritual practice, you know, my mother being diagnosed with cancer, and also being there when she was in dying, and caring for her when she was dying. I mean, I didn't have a massive emotional spiritual capacity that time, but I think because I had been, you know, we were close, and because I had been doing some meditating, and I had got a little bit of Dharma there. it meant I could be with her in a way that no one else in the family could. In fact, nobody else would actually let her talk about the fact that she was dying. They all just found it too distressing, so they just shut down the conversation and just or pretend it wasn't happening. And just the fact that I was able to be there and listen to all her feelings and her fears, and also just see what was, really, be there with what is. I know she found it really valuable, and I know I found it really valuable, and although I still miss her really deeply, and I think it was probably the most traumatic thing in my life, there was so much, actually, joy as well in that period, because we were sharing on a really deep level, connecting on a really deep level, and there was all that love there, and a lot of things that probably might not have been spoken or said. You know, she was really appreciative. She did express her love for me. You know, and she was sort of, you know, praised me to some of the sort of visiting nurses and health visitors and things. And that was really kind of powerful for me. And also just being in the room at the point, you know, she was in a coma for the last few days. She couldn't really speak, but there was a real sense of her energy. And I think the day before, there was a real sense of lightness and joy in the room. And it wasn't coming from me or anyone else in the family, so I'm assuming it came from her. I keep going in all directions. But yes, I think there's something about... if we're open, if we're closed in how we use energy. And also, obviously, are we acting in a way that's coming from greed, attachment, craving, particularly for our own needs and what we want? Are we coming from a place of ill will, aversion, hatred? Or are we just coming from a place of unawareness and delusion and views, conditioning, you know, letting ourselves be very much influenced by people around us, rather than really listening, really looking, investigating what we personally think is the most appropriate, skillful way to behave, coming from at least the intention of awareness and kindness and compassion. And that's in the little things, you know. Everything we say or do, or we don't say, we don't do, will have an impact. You know, it has consequences. So although it may not be possible for us to be aware of every single thing we say or do throughout our lives, just, you know, becoming more aware, cultivating that attitude of awareness, of kindness, that can become more of a habit. So if we're a bundle of habits, you know, one of the things that practice can do is we can establish different habits that create more positive conditions for ourselves and others to develop those seeds, that potential. You know, especially if we're coming from our spiritual values, from what's meaningful, and we're motivated by that. We're cultivating compassion, we're cultivating wisdom, and also connecting with life, world outside of ourselves, going beyond just ourselves, in a way. And energy is a resource. So we all are, as Pranyanita was saying, manifestations of form and energy. You know, so within this particular form, we have energy. We have this resource of energy, and everyone might have different amounts of energy available or at different times. But with what energy we do have available, what are we going to do with it? You know, are we going to squander that? Are we going to use it in a way that's destructive? Are we going to use it in a way that is nurturing and helpful and beneficial? And just noticing in a way connection between what we do, what we say, the impact it has on ourselves and others. I mean, that's in a way at the root of ethics as well, isn't it? Everything is conditioned, so we're conditioning factors on others in the world, and we are conditioned by others in the world. So there's internal, external conditions. We don't really have, we have very limited control over the external conditions. We have some, but we have a lot of control over the internal conditions, or how we respond, how we react. And some of it is happening, no, some of it does actually happen very quickly on a biological level before we even think about it. You know, our Vedana responses of liking, not liking, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that's coming in through our experiences, you know, sense experiences. You know, you hear a sound that can actually have a lot of influence on your mood and your energy. You know, maybe it's a song from your childhood, or when you met your first love, and it will evoke all kinds of memories and feelings. Maybe it's a sound you find a little bit threatening. Maybe it's just unexpected, you know. We see something, you know, it can delight us. It can overwhelm us. It can challenge us, you know. The experience of tasting something, smelling something. All these things do actually have an effect on us and our energy. So just being aware of that. Touch. We'll very much touch when there's a touch with someone else. You know, it can be pleasant touch, can be unpleasant touch. It can be a touch that's really loving and caring, or it can be one that can have a really negative effect on us. And all of those things will be affecting our energy. Speech and any physical activity is also an expression of our energy. So again, it's like just trying to come from a kind and caring and aware place. And if we don't, not beating ourselves up about it, because that is just part of life, the process. As Pranyanita said, when we take on the precepts, whichever precepts we're taking on, it's a long-term project. You know, we're not expecting that we're going to be able to transform ourselves, you know, within a week, a month, a year, maybe even within a lifetime. But we can change incrementally in positive ways. And sometimes those painful, difficult experiences, when we're aware that we haven't behaved skillfully or kindly, can be a catalyst for us having more awareness, seeing through our conditioning, wanting to do something differently. I'm not quite sure why, but I was thinking about various books, plays, pieces of music, and I suppose around the influence and how they'd affected me and things like that. I mean, books using words are slightly different to music, which is unspoken language, for instance. But I know for me, if there's some really loud house music coming on from the neighbours, it can drive me mad and get me really wound up. If I'm listening to something that's quite peaceful, that can help me calm. But I've also used listening to music very much as a way of reflecting, expressing feelings, emotions, states that I might not even have words for, you know, like the sort of more spiritual ones. Sometimes I might find that more listening to someone like Bach, Mozart or Schubert, when they seem to have been in that kind of a state and written a piece of music about that, you know. Something about truth, when you see a painting or you read something where someone's really closely observed in a way that's really true, even if it may not be literally true, that helps you see something clearly in yourself about your experience, about human experience. And that those little things can have an impact. So, yeah. I've always loved Jane Austen, and one of her books, Emma, You know, Emma is not always the nicest character. You know, she's meddling with everybody's lives and she's quite arrogant in lots of ways, doing all this matchmaking, thinks she knows best, causes a lot of difficulties and pain for various people along the way. But for me, there's one moment in it that is absolutely devastating, and that's when there's a group of them having a picnic on Box Hill. And then there's this elderly woman who's sort of been like a family friend, you know, and she's a bit ridiculous, but very kind. And all through the novel, you've heard her sort of monologues and, you know, found them amusing. And in this picnic, I think she's trying to impress somebody, and she just says something really dismissive. She ridicules her. And in some ways you could say, oh, that's just one little thing she said, but it, for me, that was like the real ethical thing. And for her, she realises that later, that what she did, and that then causes her to start examining how she is, how she changed. And I think we probably all have those moments in our lives when we've been aware of doing something unskillful. Are we able to allow ourselves to acknowledge that, to sit with it enough, to explore it and think, okay, I'm not going to do that again, or I don't want to do that again, and maybe I want to make amends as best I can, you know? Which is very much linked to this process, this practice, ethical practice in Buddhism, and we do also do confession in that way, you know, where we're trying to see, well, what were the conditions why I behaved in that way? You know, I don't want to do it. Do I really not want to do it again? Actually commit that you don't want to do it again. And if you think there is possibility of making amends, you make amends, but then you don't hold on to it and feel guilty for the rest of your life. You know, you use it as an impetus for positive ethical change. Yeah. So yeah, I think anything can be an opportunity, and anything can be an opportunity for spiritual development, however messy, however difficult, and often our energy in whatever context it is and our actions can be very messy. And then we can get into all of this blame and self-blame, and it's not really helpful, you know. It's good to have that sensitivity that you've done something that's not ethical, and it's good to actually not feel good about that. But again, it can be very much part of ego clinging when we sort of think, oh, I'm this terrible person, and beat ourselves up about it, and that becomes part of our identity rather than I did this and I don't have to do this in the future, and that doesn't define who I am. Yeah. So I think I'm going to leave that almost there, but I think just to say that when we're working in meditation, we're working with energy. When we're chanting a mantra, we're working with energy. When we're taking part in a ritual, we're very much working with energy, and especially in sort of ritual and mantra chanting, we may be working, and actually meditation, we may at times be working with unconscious energies, beyond words, beyond concepts. And obviously anything we say and do, we're working. But I think it's very important not just to think that what we're consciously doing is the work, you know, that actually we need to bring in all of ourselves, and some of that we may not be aware of, we may not be conscious of at the time. And I think that's where the benefits of devotional practice and things like mantras can be really helpful. So I'm going to leave you with a quote from Sangharakshita. The effort we put into our spiritual development needs to be directed towards the growth of the whole psyche, not just a part of it. We need to unify our energies, and this means enlisting the cooperation of our unconscious energies by means of myth and symbol, and by the exercise of imagination and devotion. The rational approach will not do it on its own. Okay. So we will be going into groups soon, but I just wondered if there's anything anybody felt like saying or sharing in response to anything that I said that got sparked by that, or if I was unclear around anything. Needs to get Yeah, so we've just got about half an hour, just over half an hour to the end of the session. So we'd like to sort of, we've had a lot of quite energetic energy and mental energy talking and listening. And I do like that idea of thinking of thoughts and our emotions and things as mental events, you know, coming and going in the mind, rather than getting attached to all the different thoughts in themselves or the content. But anyway, whatever content there's probably been quite a lot of activity in our hearts and minds so far. So let's have a little bit of space and stillness and quiet, a little bit of simplicity to end the session. And yeah, I think I sort of mentioned at one point something about how the input that's coming in through our senses can affect our energy. And actually, just before the session, I was sitting outside having a cup of tea and I saw a woodpecker in the neighbour's garden. I've never seen a woodpecker anywhere near here. It was very beautiful and it was just going, but it was really doing pecking the wood just like its name. And it was just such a delight, such a joy. And it was just, you know, something that came in through my sight, through my ears, and then my mood, my energy completely changed. So what we're going to do is we're basically going to be doing some just sitting or just lying or whatever you want to do, but I am going to do a little bit of playing sounds, primarily from the singing bowl first, and just see what effect that has. You know, sometimes the associations will have an effect, so like if we associate a sound with meditation and calming down, maybe that immediately kind of triggers something. Or maybe just on an energetic level of the sound waves coming through your device and what effect it has when they enter your ears and your mind. So yeah, just take a few minutes to get yourselves comfortable. So just taking your time, ending this period of meditation. And bearing in mind that it's also the end of the session, so if you have entered into a quieter, more still place, had even the littlest glimpse of stillness, simplicity or contentment, just seeing if you can stay in touch with that this afternoon. Maybe have a quiet time, create some space and stillness. Or at least simplify what you can. And we'll be coming back at 4 for a period of meditation and reflection. Maybe a few further thoughts and a puja.